Good morning, and may it please the Court. I am Cy Smith, appearing on behalf of the appellants Asmaan Azhar Khan in this matter. 5 years into this case, with the merits nowhere in sight, we're here today for the second time to review a judgment of the district court.
Well, some of the merits are in sight, are they not? I don't want to distract you, but
not really.
Well, the district court ruled on Mrs. Khan's claim.
Well, are we talking about the last issue, the intentional infliction of emotional distress?
Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think that I'll touch on that at the end. I think the district court well outstepped its bounds on that with no evidence in front of it to make essentially factual findings about the motivations of the defendants in a way that conflicts with the rule that you have to read the complaint in favor of the plaintiff, et cetera. But let me begin with the issue of waiver, because it's very clear in the National Foundation that one way that you can waive your arbitration right is through active participation in a lawsuit.
I understand the appellee's argument, it is that where the agreement contains a provision that would dispose of all the claims outside of the courtroom, it can come into court to try to dismiss the case on that ground, even though that other ground, namely here, the workers' compensation scheme, is, as it were, an alternative to going directly to arbitration.
This arbitration clause was very broad, and they had an absolute right to present their defense of workers' comp in front of the arbitration panel, but they chose not to do that. After removing in this court, the first thing that they did was to move for summary judgment.
So this case is distinguishable from the cases where the litigation has proceeded in terms of filing an answer, seeking discovery, et cetera. I mean, those cases are sort of at one end of the spectrum, it seems to me. The other case at the other end of the spectrum is somebody comes in, asks for a motion to compel arbitration, and does nothing more. Here, we're somewhere in the middle, as I see it, where somebody comes in and says, we want you to dismiss this case because under the agreement, workers' compensation scheme controls, or we want you to compel arbitration. Now, I know our court has talked about totality of the circumstances, but isn't that distinguishable from the cases that talk about litigating on the merits?
I disagree with that. If you look at National Foundation at pages 775 to 76, the court said they didn't just take discovery in that case. They moved for summary judgment. Those are the court's words. And if you think about it, moving for summary judgment is the zenith of asking for the invocation of judicial power, merely seeking a little bit of discovery, et cetera. You can't think of anything less short of trial on the merits that would be a more affirmative waiver. I think the National Foundation stands for that. If it doesn't, I think that's the rule that should be adopted. We haven't found a single case where a party has moved for summary judgment and it's been held to be not a waiver of the arbitration right. The defendants haven't found one either, and it's very possible if this court were to hold that way, it would be for the first time. And it seems to me that when you ask for summary judgment, that really is the end of the story. And the defendants were perfectly happy to have it sustained on that ground. When we were here 2 years ago, Mr. Scalia was asked, well, aren't we going to have to go back in arbitration? He said, well, the first thing we want is an affirmance on summary judgment on the merits. He said, and quoting him, he said, but if it's not, then we'll go back to arbitration. That is two bites at the apple, and you really couldn't find a better example of it. It's at Joint Appendix, page 392. The district court's explanation as to why there was no waiver here began with his argument that there was no delay here. Well, first of all, you don't need delay. This is one of two circuits that doesn't require prejudice. But 4 years of delay, it seems to me, is more than sufficient if it was even required. The district court also said, well, the defendants just filed a motion to dismiss, and it, quote, shouldn't be held against them. But this was a foregone conclusion in this case that it was going to be weighed as summary judgment because they submitted all of this extra record evidence. And Sweaterby, the case from the Second Circuit, principally relied on by the district court, said when you submit that extra record evidence and it's considered, that's summary judgment and that affects a waiver. That's a very clear ruling under Sweaterby, which applies in this case as well. Finally, the district court said, well, the defense were forced to do this. What if you're presented with frivolous claims? These claims weren't frivolous, but if they were, you can submit that defense to the arbitrator. It's a very broad arbitration clause. Now, even if there's not waiver, and we think it's very clear that there was, Then the question is this an enforceable arbitration clause? Under Volt, it's very clear that you can pick the law that applies here, and Volt was a California law case, so there can't be any question that California is off the reservation here. And the arbitration clause here, which is drafted by the defendant, PGSL, says that California law applies not just in the arbitration, but in respect of it. And the question is, well, why did the defendants choose California law? The district court held that, quote, there is absolutely no connection or relationship between the parties' dispute and California, unquote, page 338, note 13 of the published opinion. But that's not right, because the parent corporation here, Parsons Corporation, which owns all the other individual, or rather corporate defendants, is based in California. It's in paragraph 10 of the complaint. Now, we never had a hearing and weren't able to point this out to the district court, but that's why the defendants wanted California law to apply. And when you look at the arbitration clause that they drafted, it's very clear that this is what's known as an arbitration-specific choice of law clause, and not what's called a generic choice of law clause. And that's very important. It's very rare to find these. They're like the ivory-billed woodpecker of arbitration choice of law clauses. And when you find them, all the courts say that you have to enforce them and give deference to the party's contract. But the district court relied on seven generic choice of law clauses to find that you couldn't apply California law here, and compounded that error by requiring the plaintiffs to show intent to apply state law by clear and convincing evidence. That's not the law. There's no reason you can't apply state law to cases under this international convention. There's nothing in the convention that forbids it. And if you look at Article 5, Section 1A, it says that the parties can pick the law to which the agreement's enforceability will be subjected. That's a paraphrase, but it's pretty close. Once you do what the parties asked or agreed to do, or rather the defendants chose to do because they drafted the clause, then this is the most one-sided, the most unenforceable clause that's ever been seen in any case that I've ever looked at. It's got six separate problems with it, and under California law.
Go back one second. What were you paraphrasing?
I was paraphrasing Article 5, Section 1A, which makes reference to, quote, the law to which the parties subject, unquote, the parties' enforcement. That is powerful evidence that they can pick the law. California law in this case, which applies generally to all issues, to all contracts, I should say, makes this particular clause unenforceable. Now, even if we're not right about that, we have the question of non-signatories. This is a most unusual case where the district court has held that a non-signatory can force another non-signatory to arbitrate a dispute where neither of them has signed on to the agreement, and where arbitration, remember, it's not just that it's favored, it's a species of agreement, of contract.
Does it matter that they want to participate in arbitration, so it's not forcing?
Well, it's forcing the counterparty to do it. I'm just saying that you know, sometimes non-signatories are bound to it, and sometimes they're allowed to invoke. But to have non-signatories on both sides is unusual. 10 of the 11 defendants, half the plaintiffs, never signed this clause.
So your argument originally, as I understood it, was you needed discovery on this in any event in order to determine what the relationship was here?
That's correct. There was a Rule 56F affidavit. This court, 2 years ago, a little more than 2 years ago, asked the district court to go back and address those discovery issues. The way they were addressed was by telling us to go raise them before the arbitrator. Mm-hmm. Raises some questions about the care with which the district court listened to the instruction from this court.
Mr. Smith, you just quoted Article 5, Section 1A.
Yes, sir.
Which is about enforcing awards, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We're not here on enforcement of awards.
Yes. But the argument,
Article 2, the significance of which may be that it doesn't have such a clause.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, there's no affirmative evidence that you're prohibited from choosing the applicable law. None. So look at the text and see whether there's some reason to say that, you know, under the International Convention you are forbidden for any reason. And when you see that and it talks about the parties choosing the law, then that tells you that they're not forbidden from doing that. And here's another point.
Well, it tells you that about the law for enforcing of awards.
Yeah. Right.
It doesn't say anything about interpretation of the arbitration clause.
But it's the only evidence in the convention or the statute that bears on whether or not the parties can choose law. That's the only indication anywhere in it. The only thing past that I want to point out is 9 U.S.C. Section 208, which is the last clause in the statute implementing the convention. That statute says that if that Title I or Chapter 1, which is the Federal Arbitration Act, will apply to proceedings under the convention unless it conflicts with something in the convention or in Chapter 2. And under the FAA, people are always choosing the applicable law. So with no evidence that you can't do it, and certainly some evidence that you can, seems to me that that's sufficient. With respect to the non-signatories, you know, this is a situation where the tail is wagging the dog. There's a grab bag of arguments that were addressed by the district court about estoppel, the claim that all the defendants were lumped together. It seems to me that those arguments conflict with Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 8, which allows us to have notice pleading here, and also with an observation made by Chief Judge Ginsburg when we were here 2 years ago, who said that lumping the defendants together, that's a very unforgiving reading of the complaint in this case. Smith and Enron cited by them simply does not apply here. And as to Mrs. Kahn, the idea that husbands automatically have the power to bind their wives is a somewhat antediluvian view of the law here. There's no evidence that Mr. Kahn had authority, and affirmative evidence he didn't. Look at his declaration, Joint Appendix 137. I don't want to sit down with saying a little bit about the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. The district court in this case held that there was, quote, no evidence that the problems here, the torture, was caused by the defendants. The defendants were simply trying to defuse the situation, doing whatever they could to secure his release. The district court held on the basis of no evidence that negotiations are, quote, risky and unpredictable, best left in the hands of experts. Now, that's not just a holding on the intentional infliction claim. That permeates the entire case, and there is no basis here for those sorts of rulings. It seems to me that those rulings are a little bit beyond the pale, and they raise some questions about the methodology and the approach of the district court in this case. Last time around, there were instructions about what to do. The district court shunted all those off to arbitration. This time around, you have that kind of ruling on the intentional infliction claim, and to me, to us, the plaintiffs, it raises questions about the entire approach of the district court in this case. And we ask that the judgment be reversed, and I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Chief Judge Ginsburg, and may it please the court, Matthew McGill for the appellees. As part of his employment agreement, Mr. Kahn agreed to arbitrate any dispute arising out of his employment.
Let's talk about waiver, your motion for summary judgment. How do you respond?
The only black letter law with regard to waiver in this case is that you cannot waive an affirmative defense before an answer. And arbitration and award is an affirmative defense under Rule 8. And you simply, under Rule 12H, you can't waive an affirmative defense before answer. That's point one. Point two, under their view, we should have moved to compel arbitration first, and then, if that were denied, then brought our summary motion to dismiss, and in the alternative for summary judgment on workman's compensation. That's their view. But
it was your view, or counsel for the defendant's view, when a letter was written saying to the counsel for the comms, dismiss your case. Let's go to arbitration.
In favor of arbitration. We did that 3 months after the filing of the complaint, almost immediately after we were served
right.
with the complaint.
So my only point is it was your view, too, at least before you came in and you filed your motion.
It's been our view from the outset of the case that this should be dismissed in favor of arbitration. Mm-hmm. At our first substantive motion,
So you think you can come in and ask for summary judgment so long as your motion includes as an alternative seeking a motion to compel arbitration, and you have not waived your right to arbitration?
I have two answers to that. First, our first substantive motion in the case raised two objections to the judicial forum. There was two objections to the judicial forum. We argued workman's compensation and arbitration. Second point, if we had not proceeded in that manner, if we had moved to compel arbitration first, the plaintiffs would be standing here arguing under Rule 12G, the emphatic policy of which is consolidation of defenses in pre-arbitration motions to dismiss, pre-answer motions to dismiss, excuse me, they would be arguing that we cannot raise our workman's compensation defense prior to answer. So,
do you have a case on that?
A case on what?
Upholding that point.
Well, Judge Friendly in 1965 in a case called Chatham Shipping.
Yeah, but the Second Circuit has gone beyond that Friendly opinion.
Oh, I don't think so. I think they stand by the rule that you can't waive an affirmative defense before answer. And Sweater B by Banff certainly doesn't support the contrary proposition. Suffice it to say, though, this case could not be more different from National Foundation, where the defendants answered twice.
And that was my point in my first question. That's why I want to understand where we are on the spectrum between coming in and only asking for a motion to compel and doing what has happened in all of these other cases where there's been a lot more going on.
It's quite clear we're far from National Foundation. We had not even answered. It seems quite clear under Rule 12H, we cannot waive an affirmative defense prior to answer. They say that any motion for summary judgment constitutes a waiver, but that's really a distortion of the law.
But as I understand your position here is that even though this court has ruled on the workers' compensation issue, you still can raise that before arbitration de novo.
There were certainly aspects of our workman's compensation claim or arguments that were not addressed by this court. Certain claims that Mr. Kahn makes that are indisputably part of his employment. He alleges in his complaint that he was injured in the course of his employment when we asked him to do work. So there were parts of it that were not addressed by this court, and we do preserve the right to raise those in arbitration in the first instance, and it will be up to the arbitrator to determine the preclusive effect of this court's decision and the extent of it.
So your position is that under National Foundation, it cannot be the rule in this circuit that filing a motion for summary judgment based on an affirmative defense that would oust the court of jurisdiction is, quote, litigating on the merits, close quote, sufficient to constitute a waiver of your right to arbitration.
I think it's true that none of the cases cited by the plaintiffs here, when they talk about a summary judgment motion constituting waiver, all of those cases are summary judgment motions that go to the substance of the allegations in the complaint. They are not motions for summary judgment that go to the appropriateness of the judicial forum for the resolution of those claims.
I don't recall this in your brief. Did you make this argument in your brief?
We certainly did make the argument in the brief that our motion for workman's compensation was a argument that went to the appropriateness of the judicial forum.
I'm sorry, reference to the non-waivability of a defense.
No, we did not make it. I did not make that argument in the brief, but it's in the rules of.
For it now.
Excuse me?
It's a little late for it now.
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, just because it is one that emanates from the rules of civil procedure.
It doesn't go to our jurisdiction.
It does not go to your jurisdiction, but I would also note that the waiver defense in this case was raised for the first time after this court addressed the arbitration defense in the last hearing before this court. If the waiver defense were so obvious, if it were so obvious that we had waived, one would think they would have raised the waiver defense in their brief to this court in 2005, but they did not.
Well, did you argue in your brief that they waived the waiver?
No, we did not argue that they waived the waiver, but
that's not a good use of our time either.
Well, okay. If I can turn to some of the other arguments raised by the plaintiffs here. As I noted, Mr. Kahn seeks to repudiate his agreement based on the law of California. He argues that the agreement to arbitrate is unconscionable and thus unenforceable. Plaintiff's reliance on California law is badly misplaced. In 2005,
so do you agree on the choice of law argument he makes?
No.
To the convention?
No, we don't, but I just want to.
I thought your brief was embracing the Third Circuit's approach in Rome.
We certainly are, but we certainly do agree that federal law here applies. Under Article 2, Section 3 of the convention, this court's review is very circumscribed. If there is an agreement to arbitrate, this court shall refer the parties to arbitration unless it is null and void. Every federal court of appeals that has addressed the meaning of null and void has held that it must be construed narrowly in view of the emphatic federal policy in favor of international arbitrations, and has held that it embraces only internationally recognized defenses to contract such as waiver, duress, mistake. These are all, so it seems quite clear that the court's review here is circumscribed to determining whether the contract is null and void as that term is defined by federal law. It's beyond dispute that treaties are interpreted according to federal law. So the plaintiffs here cite no precedent because there is none for refusing to enforce an international arbitration agreement under the convention on the ground of unconscionability. This court should not become the first because in this case, the suggested basis for doing so is an interpretation of California law that the California Supreme Court has rejected. In 2005, the California Supreme Court decided a case called Bogos versus certain underwriters at Lloyd's of London. And Chief Judge Ginsburg, I regret it's not cited in any of the briefs, but it is reported at 115 Pacific 3rd, 68, and it there says, we have not extended the Amadeus cost-shifting rule to common law claims generally, and unanimously held that such an extension was unlawful. That's at pages 75 and 76 of that opinion. Plaintiffs are asking this court to do what the courts of California cannot, which is to restrict arbitration of common law claims, a result that this court and others have recognized is forbidden by the FAA, and doubly so in the context of an international arbitration agreement where the policy favoring enforcement of that agreement applies with particular force.
So the result of that interpretation is that null and void takes you to arbitration automatically under this analysis, even though if the arbitrator issues an award, it is subsequently determined that the award is unconscionable under California law.
That is, in fact, the structure of the convention. Under Article 2, you are referred, the court shall refer the parties to arbitration unless null and void. Under Article 5, once there is an award, it is at that time that the parties may challenge the award as invalid, either under the law of the selected forum or the law of the forum in which arbitration was held. That is the structure of the convention, and it reflects the fundamental policy of the convention, which was the standardization of the rules pursuant to which the signatory nations would enforce arbitration agreements. So unless the plaintiffs here can make out a showing that the agreement here is null and void, and there is no case supporting that proposition, there is no case that says that null and void embraces unconscionability. And in fact, the 11th Circuit in the Bautista versus Star Cruise cases specifically held that null and void does not embrace state law principles of unconscionability. So under those circumstances, this court really has very little discretion except to refer the parties to arbitration. It is in that forum that the plaintiffs can raise their California defenses to the enforceability of the agreement.
Well, I guess the point would be then at this stage, all the court could do that would say is that any award that an arbitrator might enter would be unconscionable under California law, and therefore arbitration.
Actually, I think under the terms of the convention, you would have to find that the agreement is null and void. And there's no court. The agreement to arbitrate is null and void. If the entire agreement were unconscionable, if that were the allegation under prima paint, that would be for the arbitrator. But In this case, there is no allegation or no support for the allegation that unconscionability is embraced within that treaty term null and void. Mm-hmm. So, Judge Rogers, I'd like to address just a couple other reasons we think that California law mm-hmm. is not meant to determine the enforceability of the arbitration agreement itself. There's something very peculiar, of course, about the plaintiff's argument. They argue that the arbitration agreement, the arbitration clause, is unenforceable, but yet they seek the enforcement of a portion of that clause, the choice of law clause. That you cannot at the same time argue that the clause, that the arbitration clause is unenforceable and demand enforcement of just a part of it.
That's an alternative argument.
It's an alternative argument, yes, but there are other reasons. I'm just suggesting why California law does not govern the arbitrability here. Second, if California law governs the unconscionability defense, that enforcement defense, it also has to govern the waiver defense, because waiver is just as much a defense to the enforcement of the agreement. Yet, in that context, perhaps because it suits them, they argue that federal law applies. So they seem to acknowledge that federal law actually does govern the enforceability of these agreements. Finally, I would note that it leads to an absolutely absurd interpretation of the choice of law, of the arbitration clause, that the parties agreed to arbitrate and then chose a substantive rule of decision that would annihilate that same agreement to arbitrate.
Well, they argue that under your interpretation, the language in regard to becomes superfluous.
Well, they do argue that, but that's not much of an answer to the point that if they're right that California law renders all employment arbitration agreements unenforceable, that one would agree to arbitrate all claims arising out of a dispute, and then in the very next breath say, we're going to render that foregoing agreement unenforceable by choosing California law. The restatement of conflicts of law says that's not how you interpret a contract.
I understand that to be their agreement, their argument. Not that any arbitration would be unconscionable under California law, but that in these six respects that they identify.
Well, the six respects they identify with respect to, I would say, embrace virtually every agreement to arbitrate employment. It simply cannot be the law that it is unconscionable for international parties to agree to arbitrate an international dispute under international rules in the leading international forum. That simply cannot be the law of unconscionability. And in fact, the Supreme Court, in cases such as Shirk versus Alberto Culver, seemed fairly to indicate that it's not. And another case that comes to mind are the forum selection clauses that the Supreme Court has decided, such as Carnival Cruise Lines versus Shoot. But in those cases, that the court upheld a forum selection clause that was printed on the back of a ticket.
I want to ask you, before you sit down, what you're about to do, to restate the holding in the California case that is not cited in the brief.
Yes, sir. It states, and we have not extended the Armendariz-Little cost-shifting rule to common law claims generally, and they unanimously held that the extension of that rule to common law claims would be unlawful.
That simply meant you could share costs.
Excuse me?
That it wasn't unconscionable under this agreement on the cost provision.
The Armendariz rule is as you note, a cost-shifting rule. It is a special rule that's layered on top of California's general law of unconscionability. Mm-hmm. It is the rule on which they rely. And the California Supreme Court has said it doesn't extend to common law claims. And moreover, it cannot be gainsaid that we've agreed to pay the costs of the arbitration. And in any event,
But you have to agree that the law is settled, that we have to look at unconscionability at the time the contract is entered.
Actually,
not what you may have agreed to after the fact.
Well, under the Supreme Court's decision in Greentree Financial versus Randolph, this court is not allowed to speculate as to how an arbitrator is going to allocate costs.
Oh, I understand that, but that's a different issue.
Well, I don't think it is a different issue.
You were throwing in that you had offered to pay.
Well, we had offered to pay, and
it's irrelevant. It's my point. as to their unconscionability argument.
Well, I don't, if I can just...
Unless that were in the agreement itself, and it's not in the agreement.
If I could just press that point just a little. In Green Tree Financial, the holding of the Supreme Court was that the plaintiff had not yet come forward with enough evidence to demonstrate that she would be saddled with the costs. It just can't be true that anything after the agreement is irrelevant. And in this case, we've agreed to pay the costs under Green Tree Financial. At most, their view of how the costs are going to be arbitrated, whether they get punitive damages, whether they'll get discovery, all of that is speculative under Green Tree Financial, and it's something that this court, that a California court, in any event, could address under Article 5 at the enforcement award stage, at the award enforcement stage.
This is the California case that you discussed, the Bogus?
Bogus.
Yeah. The court says that it's leaving open the following question. Whether the clause of the arbitration provision requiring Bogus to share the cost of the arbitrator's fees is unenforceable under the general law of unconscionability. That was left to the trial court.
That's correct. So what it does is it says that the Armendariz rule, which was a special rule for arbitrations, for employment arbitration specifically, the Armendariz rule does not apply to common law claims. We're left with the general law of unconscionability, which requires that under the substantive wing of the doctrine, which requires that the terms of the contract be fundamentally bilateral. It is not at all one-sided for international parties to agree to split costs 50-50 and to agree to allow the split advance costs 50-50 and then to allow the arbitrator to decide how to allocate those costs in the end. That's Rule 31 of the ICC rules. It provides that the arbitrator shall allocate the costs in a manner that it determines.
The question left open is whether the allocation here, pardon me, was unconscionable. So that's an open question as far as this case is concerned under California law.
Yes, that is true, Judge Ginsburg.
So unconscionability, they didn't say unconscionability is inapplicable here. On the contrary.
No, they say
that it's applicable, and the question was whether, as a general matter, whether on the facts this was unconscionable.
I would add only that Bogos unambiguously holds that the Armendariz rule does not apply to common law claims. Then the question is, under the general rules of unconscionability, that it cannot be an overly oppressive contract of adhesion and that the terms cannot be overwhelmingly one-sided, under that generic principle of California law, is it unconscionable? And the Supreme Court cases in this, which are determined as federal law, yes, but have preemptive effect here because of the FAA, the Supreme Court has addressed, in Circuit City versus Adams, it addressed a form of employment arbitration agreement that was printed on the back of an employment application. In Carnival Cruise versus Shute, it addressed a form selection clause that was printed on the back of a ticket. These are arbitration clauses are just a specific type of forum selection clause. So these are, under these general principles, it would seem that the FAA commands the result that it is not unconscionable. To be sure, Doctors Associate versus Casarotto, that's a 1995 case from the Supreme Court, it says that under Chapter 1 of the FAA, you apply state law principles of unconscionability. But under Chapter 2, the question is, what is null and void? And that is determined exclusively, as the meaning of all treaties are, is determined exclusively as a matter of federal law. And no court has ever held that term to embrace state law principles of unconscionability. And the 11th Circuit has specifically rejected the proposition. Chief Judge Ginsburg, with your indulgence, I would like to address for 2 minutes the question of non-signatories.
Yeah, and I'd like to address the intentional infliction of emotional distress as well, but do the non-signatories first.
Okay, so I promised Judge Griffith I will end on that point. Non-signatories, I think it's helpful to break it up into pieces. So let's first start by talking about the ability of a non-signatory to bind a signatory to the arbitration agreement. Specifically here, the non-signatory defendants to bind Mr. Khan to his arbitration agreement. Mm-hmm.
I forget which circuit it is. It spelled out the five considerations.
And yes, it's the Second Circuit.
Second Circuit, yeah.
And the one that's relevant here is equitable estoppel.
Yeah.
And it's not just the Second Circuit. The Fourth Circuit, the Fifth Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, and the Eleventh Circuit all have embraced the idea that a signatory can be estopped from avoiding arbitration of claims that arise out of the contract. And Mr. Khan's claims here arise out of his employment agreement, as he fundamentally acknowledges by never disputing the scope of the arbitration clause. So that's the rule. Is the signatory of the contract equitably estopped from avoiding arbitration of claims he agreed to arbitrate with respect to the signatory?
How does negligence grow out of the contract?
Because his negligence claims here could only be founded based on the duty of his employer. And he's admitted as much, at least implicitly, by never contesting the scope of the arbitration clause here. He has at no time, at any point in the litigation, said that the negligence and intentional infliction of emotional distress claims are beyond the scope of the arbitration. Mindful of the fact that I'm exceeding my time, I'll move on. Whether Mrs. Khan can be bound by the arbitration agreement. It's the same Second Circuit case, Judge Rogers, the Thompson case. And in this case, the question is whether she can be equitably estopped from avoiding arbitration. And the test, as applied in the Thompson case, was whether she received a direct benefit from the contract.
And what is that direct benefit?
She receives a number of direct benefits, but I'll give you just one example. One example is that the contract provides for air transportation for the employee and the authorized dependents for vacations twice a year. That's it.
I argue the health as well.
Excuse me?
The medical benefits.
There are other benefits as well, but I find it the plane ticket provision, which is at JA 35, I find that to be especially instructive because it is a benefit that is conferred specifically on the authorized dependent, in this case, Mrs. Khan. And indeed, if the company had refused to provide that plane ticket, she could have sued under the contract as a third-party beneficiary. So I don't think it can be seriously disputed that she received at least some benefits under the terms of this agreement. The question is whether that's enough to equitably stop her from avoiding claims that arise out of the contract. And here, we think the negligence claim, for the same reason her husband's negligence claim arises out of the contract, Mrs. Khan's negligence claim is really purely derivative of her husband's. And in that set of circumstances, we think that she ought to be equitably estopped from avoiding arbitration. She has a claim that's purely derivative of another arbitrable claim. Finally, Judge Griffith, the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. Our position before the district court was that this claim should be arbitrated. It's fundamentally part of the same dispute. To be sure, we agree with Judge Lambert's conclusion that we did not act in a manner that is outrageous. But our position was that this was a claim that was within the scope of the arbitration agreement, and because everything else in this case is being arbitrated, it ought to be arbitrated too. That was our position in the district court. If you disagree with that, the right result is to stay that claim pending resolution of the arbitration. That's under the footnote 23 of the Moses H. Cohen decision of the Supreme Court and this court's decision in DSMC versus Convera. So that would be the right result if you disagree with Judge Lambert's decision to dismiss the case. But it was not our position below that the claim should be dismissed on the merits in the manner that Judge Lamberth did. Mm-hmm. If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It puts the court, if summary judgment is not a black line, black letter, bright line rule, it should be, because it is the ultimate invocation of judicial power here. And that way we wouldn't have these disputes about where you fall on the spectrum or their argument that there was some kind of waiver issue. And you can fix the issue of waiver by simply saying that we won't find a waiver of one of these affirmative defenses if you move for arbitration right out of the box.
But would you agree that so far, at any rate, the cases have gone to what I'll call the substantive merits, using Appley's term, not trying to oust the judicial forum?
No. And first of all, on the merits in this case, this is not like a venue defense or something like that. If they had won, we would be out forever in court. There would be no claim that could be brought in any court because of the workers' comp defense. So that's on the merits by any definition, but those cases do not draw that distinction. And what we need here is a little bit of clarity, and it's completely consistent, in fact, the rule of National Foundation, that it's summary judgment that should be that rule. As far as their argument on waiver is concerned, if they had won their motion to compel arbitration, there wouldn't be waiver because we'd be in Geneva, Switzerland, and the arbitrators there, as best we can tell, they don't apply the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. With respect to unconscionability, the whole point here, and we heard mention of prime of paint, is that
Could I just go back? What's the point of your last comment about not applying the federal rules?
The argument was that if they hadn't raised this, then they would be deemed to waive it. Of course, that's an argument not in their brief or anywhere else. But assuming that it's considered, they're saying we had to do it because otherwise we'd be deemed to waive. And if they'd done it the right way, we'd be in Geneva, and, you know, then they'd be able to make any argument they liked. But with respect to unconscionability, we heard mention of prima paint, and the whole point about prima paint is that when you have a generic argument about fraud and the inducement or something like that, that will fly. But when you have a case like this, again, the ivory-billed woodpecker, where the parties expressly choose the law to be applied to arbitration, then you have to give effect to it. And that's why this case is different from all of the other ones. The second point is that unconscionability actually has been recognized as a defense under the International Convention. There's two cases cited at page 43 of our brief, and one of them is a Court of Appeals decision. The other is in Vire, which is a district court decision, I think, from Texas. The third point is to refer something to arbitration under the International Convention, you have to have an agreement. But if it's unconscionable, then there is no such agreement. And so under the terms of the convention, even if it applies, it wouldn't require reference here. And finally, it says that you can't refer to if it's incapable of performance. When the parties choose the law to be applied and it makes it unconscionable, it's not capable of being performed. So right on the on the express language of it, it seems to me we win. With respect to BOGOS, a case that was not only not in the briefs, but was not mentioned in supplemental authority, all that does, and I see I'm out of time, but if I could just have the court's indulgence for a minute or so, all that does is say that you can consider it. It's not going to be automatically disqualifying as a matter of unconscionability, as best I can tell from the repartee between Chief Judge Ginsburg and Mr. McGill. But in this case, we had a $175,000 entrance fee to go into arbitration. Surely that is unconscionable under California law. And even if it weren't, that's just one of the six defects in this arbitration clause. And it would leave the statute of limitations issue, fee shifting, and so on. The argument that is made that, you know, this is an absurdity, we couldn't choose California law and then have the thing found to be unenforceable, I think that that's not absurd at all. And I'm joined in this case by Judge Ginsburg, who 2 years ago heard the argument and said, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense to me. He said, that's not absurd at all. He said, I don't see that as an absurd construction. It would be true of any claim of unconscionability under a contract. And it seems to me that when we're trying to look at what law should govern the issue of waiver, the argument that California law should govern is not in their brief and has never been raised by them in any court below or here. But it seems to me perfectly logical that when you're trying to decide the effect of actions you take in a federal district court, that federal law of procedure should apply there. Briefly on the issue of non-signatories. The first issue is of non-signatories binding a signatory. There's no estoppel here, and this is, I think, a very fundamental point. There's no estoppel here because Mr. Kahn is not claiming under the contract. Nowhere in the complaint do we talk about the contract. There's no claim for breach of contract. He's not claiming that benefits owed him under the contract were not paid to him. And neither is Mrs. Khan. That's the whole point. And that's why one of the reasons this court found that the workers' comp bar does not apply. The claim that Mrs. Khan was an intended direct beneficiary and that she could have sued for airplane tickets, she didn't sue for them, and it's not in their brief.
Right now, when I asked Mr. McGill about this, he said there couldn't be negligence without a duty, and the duty is the one that arises from the employment relationship.
Right, and our primary theory of liability here is that when you voluntarily inject yourself into a dispute, whether you're a bystander, you happen to know somebody from employment or from your church or whatever, and then you take over that dispute and you commit affirmative acts and also omissions by failing to tell them the amount of the ransom, that makes you liable for the consequences. That's our negligence or gross negligence claim.
Well, if it's the employer taking over the dispute, and the employer has a pre-existing duty, that would not broaden the duty beyond whatever it was.
I think that it would, and the argument that you just recited to me is exactly the argument that was made by them in trying to sustain the workers' comp summary judgment. When we were here the last time, that's exactly the argument they made. They said, oh, it all arises out of our duty owed to him as an employer. And this court rejected that argument.
Well, I think what we said was that this set of facts did not arise out of the normal, ordinary course of his employment.
Right.
Right. Not that it was unrelated to the fact that he was an employee. They didn't ask a stranger for
true.
Ransom money. Right.
True.
They asked his employer.
True. But the fact that they chose to join in the negotiations and to stonewall and cause the torture of Mr. Khan was not because they were his employer. And it's not. It has nothing to do with the employment agreement here. The issue is whether the agreement that has the arbitration clause in it is being relied upon by someone who's trying to ward off arbitration. That's not the case here. We're not claiming under the employment agreement. Neither of the plaintiffs is. And in that situation, you don't have estoppel under any circumstances, Second Circuit or this circuit. You know, that's our contention there. The intentional infliction of emotional distress claim is simply a travesty the way the district court handled it. And we ask that the judgment.
The district court agreed with you there that it's not out of the arising out of the contract.
Well, I guess I should count my blessings then. We asked
that. Maybe that one does arise out of the contract.
Yeah. So how many ivory-billed woodpeckers are there?
Well, that's the question. People say there was one that they spotted 5 years ago, but you'll see a lot of discussion in the case that, well, this is a generic choice of law clause, so, you know, we can't enforce the party's agreement.
I'm talking about ivory-billed woodpeckers.
Right. Oh, I was talking metaphorically, you're talking literally. It depends whether you believe the fella.
I thought you were talking about Crown Victorias.
Yes.
Yeah. I think there's more Crown Victorias than there are ivory-billed woodpeckers.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Mr. McGill, thank you. The case is submitted.